7. Welcome to the second half of Week 7's Worth of Material. Today we are going to be joined by Ryan Pike of The Nation Network. And Ryan's here to talk to us today about an issue that is extremely important to understand when you are trying to understand virtually every issue in the professional sports industry and certainly in the professional hockey industry as well, and that is the collective bargaining agreement. Now, you may be familiar with the CBA. You might be familiar with the notion of what a collective bargaining agreement is. In fact, at this very time, you yourself might be part of a union that has collectively bargained for specific rights and freedoms with your employer. You might have been part of a union and are no longer. It is important to understand the CBA and the way it relates to the industry as a whole. But I think before we get started with Ryan, it is important to note what the function of a collective bargaining agreement is within the larger context of labor in North America and also just within the sport industry as well. Now, this works a little bit better when we're in person, and I often do this when we are in person, so you have to just indulge me as I perform a thought exercise with you as you're listening to this right now. Perhaps you're walking around or sitting down or somewhere, or just imagine that we are all gathered together in a large room. All of us are here together. All of your classmates are sitting next to you. You've been in many classes, so as you enter fourth year, imagine this is no different from that situation, but instead of me in front of you, it's, say, Keith Pelly of MLSC, and he walks in the door and he says, I need one of you to become the new assistant general manager of the Toronto Maple Leafs. I believe that Brock has a track record of producing elite talent in this regard, and I'd like you to be the next in line to become the general manager of the Leafs. So, the starting salary here, we are going to start our salary at, say, $75,000 to do this job, which is not a great amount of money, but okay. So, you're sitting there and you're thinking to yourself, I probably would like such a job one day. Maybe perhaps I don't feel like I'm terribly qualified for it, but if it has to go to someone in this room, I mean, how many of you would put up your hands and say, I'd like to do it, right? Okay, great. So they would say, fantastic, awesome. I've changed my mind. The starting salary is now $65,000. And you say, okay, well, that's not so different from 70. It's not a great starting salary, certainly, to begin with, but okay, 65, I'd still do it. It's my dream job, absolutely. And several hands, I would imagine, are going up here, though I'm imagining also that you yourself may have already put up your hands and said that there's probably a number quite a bit lower than this that you'd keep your hand up for. And this process repeats itself. And he says 50. And he says 45. And he says 30. And he says 20. And think to yourself really carefully here. Would you put your hand up for a job like that at $10,000 or less? Now, he's not allowed to, but just imagine that for the purposes of this thought experiment, how this sort of works. This is called a reverse auction, and it has a very important resonance for many of you as you enter into the sport industry, and something that I've talked to you if you've been in one of my classes previously. It's a process that doesn't explicitly happen, but it does happen to a lot of people as they enter the sports industry, because the idea is that the Brendan Shanahan or Brendan Shanahan's types or MLSC or any of the various organizations that hire in the sports industry know the fact that what is the number that you'd be willing to do it, this particular role, and is that number zero? Would you do it for free? Many of you might, right? That might be the idea. The idea is that you might perform this duty for actually no compensation at all because it's your dream job. Maybe you have the financial situation that would allow you to do it. Maybe you do not, right? But imagine I'm asking you to perform this thought experiment for the role of assistant general manager. And many people perform roles farther down the food chain, way farther down the food chain, for the same rates of compensation. Now, the reverse auction, as it occurs to many people who are entering into the sporting industry, occurs because of the overwhelming number of people that are interested in working in sports. It's just a comment on the industry. It's not a castigation of it. It's just a simple fact. It's why these types of things exist. It doesn't mean that I have to enjoy it, or doesn't mean that I should not look out for opportunities for students and make sure that they are compensated as fairly as possible, but it does happen, right? So one of the issues here is, if all of you knew for beforehand that Brendan Shanahan was going to come into class and you all agreed that none of you would accept a job for less than $70,000, your ability to negotiate with Shanahan becomes much stronger. And in fact, then if all of you agree that no one will work for less than $70,000, then it becomes an open competition for those of you in that room who are most qualified, and not simply a race to see who will fill the position for the least amount of money. So you see here, that is a crude example, a very small example of how collective bargaining works. If I can negotiate with each of you individually, if I can make you work for your lowest possible dollar amount, if I can use you individually against each other, the group itself, then I can often pay you far less than I would often want to have paid you, or in fact even have budgeted to pay you. Collective bargaining is a process that didn't just arrive in pro sports. Certainly by fourth year, you've learned about it. I know that in first year, Craig Hyatt's class, you go through Marvin Miller and the unions and all that good stuff. And it's important to know a couple things about the collective bargaining agreement. Certainly, Ryan is going to fill you in greater detail as well. One of the most important things is the collective bargaining agreement is a living document. It lives and breathes and changes. And it is, yes, it's a set of rules, absolutely, but it's a declaration that you and an organization and you're the people that represent the labor of that organization are here to work together under a certain framework of rules, regulations, and safety. And throughout the history of North America, the collective workers' rights have been collectively bargained and brought innovations like the 6-day work week, and then the 5-day work week, and the 8-hour working day. There used to be no restrictions on how much an employee could work. There used to be no such thing, really, as the idea of a notion of a weekend. There was maybe the 1 day off a week for religious grounds, but there certainly was 12-hour shifts, absolutely. Workers' rights have developed in many cases throughout the 20th century into the 21st, based on the premise that in many industries, certain frameworks and protections need to be collectively bargained for the reverse auction reasons that I described earlier on here, right? It's a nasty business out there when you're having to fend for yourself without the protection of a group of people. And in most industries in sport that are not unionized, that are not on the side of the sort of playing of sport itself. And again, as you've known from going through this program, that unionized sporting labor is not universal. Certainly we're seeing one of the effects of that has been the LIV Golf Saudi takeover of sport. It's of the sport of golf here, or the merger with the PGA. It's sort of the PGA Tour, I should say. And that's something that's important to note here is that it is impossible to have pulled off what the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund, the PEIF, Public Investment Fund, was able to do what they did, in large part because each individual golfer on the PGA Tour is in fact an independent contractor. That is not possible to do if each individual golfer was a part of a larger union. And you see the idea here, right? So it's important as we talk about the hockey industry to note that this collective bargaining agreement has wide-ranging effects and it governs lots of things, not just the rules of the game itself and how it's going to be played and the rules of overtime and the lengths of sticks and then what kinds of equipment can be used and all that good stuff. That comes as a part of it as well. But the idea is, okay, there are certain frameworks, how many days off, how long the season can be, participation in certain tournaments, participation in some sorts of all-star games, all that kind of stuff. That has to be collectively bargained, right? And it is incredibly important to understand how this relates to everything. Because again, the collective bargaining agreement that saw the end of the 2004-05 lockout stipulated the creation of something else that's very important to the way that professional hockey is understood as an industry, and that is the creation of a salary cap. Salary caps exist, obviously, in many sports, and also famously don't exist in other sports, but the creation of a salary cap in 2005 was collectively bargained, and the idea is it serves the interests of players in some facets, and it serves the interests of owners in others, and I will also have you think to yourself sometimes about what certain parts of the CBA, whose interests are being served most acutely. We're going to learn about something today called escrow. Maybe you know about it. Maybe you do not. That's okay. And I think Ryan does a great job explaining what escrow is and its implications. And he's come into our class a few times, and this is a more recent version of our conversation. Certainly we've geared it more towards escrow because escrow is something that brings up a lot of questions. And Ryan has spent a great deal of time studying the collective bargaining agreement. Anyone can watch it. Anyone can read it, I should say. And I do encourage you to look up the NHL collective bargaining agreement and have a look and see what it's like and the language contained within it and see if you can parse it yourself. But throughout this conversation with Ryan, when you're hearing things about the collective bargaining agreement or even if about escrow itself, think to yourself, whose interests are being served here? Okay, so I will not take up any more of this time. We'll go to our discussion with Ryan. Ryan Pike is a member of the Professional Hockey Writers Association, which means he's a credentialed member of the media. He goes to practices. He's in the locker rooms. He is credentialed on game day. He sits in the press box. He has a show. He co-hosts a show on a Sportsnet radio network out in Calgary. And he has been involved in the game for a decade plus now and is a great contact as well for any of you interested in hockey media, but also any of you interested in the CBA, in stadium arena financing negotiations. He's also a whiz amazed at how those things have worked out as well. And I trust his work is only just beginning there as it relates to the negotiations in Alberta. So no further ado, here's Ryan, and I'll be back with your audio response question at the conclusion of our conversation. We are joined by Ryan Pike of The Nation Network. Ryan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Ryan is here. He is an expert on all things hockey. We are here to ask him questions today about a topic that he is extremely knowledgeable about, and that is the NHL and the CBA. Ryan, when did you start developing an interest in the CBA and the salary cap and all this sort of minutia of NHL bargaining?
Well, I grew up in Calgary as a hockey fan, and you know, up until 2005, there was no salary cap in the NHL. So I think a lot of fans, even a lot of media, were, you know, somewhat ignorant to sort of the behind the scenes minutia of the league, because it wasn't really relevant to covering the NHL. But really, you know, once the salary cap came in 2005, coming out of that lockout, I think a lot of fans, like I was back then, really tried to sort of try to develop an understanding of the rules of the game, because, you know, even just knowing, you know, I think the big thing that a lot of folks got interested in with the cap of the CBA specifically was, you know, what the rules of the game are, because, you know, before the collective bargaining agreement changed and they entered into a salary cap, the 30 NHL teams, it was 20 something for a while when I was growing up, you could basically spend wherever you wanted. There was no rules or limitations. So it basically meant that there were rich teams that could spend wherever they wanted, and there were poor teams that could spend wherever they wanted. And if you were a poor team, especially, you know, in the 90s, when the Canadian dollar took a hit, some of the smaller market Canadian teams really struggled. You know, Calgary is one of them, Winnipeg, Edmonton, Vancouver to a certain extent. And it was tough sledding. And one of the reasons, you know, why the CBA is the way it is now is because a lot of the smaller market owners were really pushing for some sort of equity in terms of how the game was administered. And part of that was a salary cap. And a lot of the rest of that was, you know, figuring out a lot of ways to codify some of the unwritten rules of how hockey was managed and put them into a living document.
That's a great description there. First of all, on that topic of it being a living document, if you're a hockey fan and maybe you understand basically what the CBA is, but maybe you're still kind of trying to figure it out, and you're maybe still learning like what factors influence the creation of the CBA. When you first look at the CBA, what's the sort of first impression you have when you're gazing upon it, or when you go to look to find a specific part of it?
Thank God there's an index. It's the index, the table of contents of the CBA is itself many pages. The CBA file, I usually have it open if I have a question about things. Like the CBA document itself, the PDF is over 540 pages, including all of the addendums and appendices. They recently, during the first pandemic stoppage, they extended the CBA through, I believe, September 2026. So the four-year extension on its own is 71 pages. So between the two documents, there's 680 or 620 some pages of stuff. And there's a lot of the stuff is, to be honest, kind of legal boilerplate. But, you know, there's a bunch of the sections are really useful just for understanding how the game is administered and sort of what limiting factors there are in a lot of player movement and contracts, salaries, those kind of things. So thank God there's a table of contents, because there's too much without one.
And yeah, absolutely. And when you are gazing upon it, when you're trying to use that index, when you're trying to answer a specific question, are you ever struck by how much of the game is governed by the CBA? Like if you don't understand the CBA, if you don't understand maybe how the CBA works with regards to player movement, how much of the game do you feel like you're missing? Is it a substantial part of hockey fandom is related to the CBA?
I think the CBA touches on the game a lot more than folks would think, because even just the idea of, during the last couple of years, we've had more and more teams play, you know, during the first COVID outbreaks earlier this season, we had teams play short by players because of specific rules that administer the salary cap, and to the point where the league actually had to, work with the Players Association and come up with sort of a one-year modifier to change, you know, something as simple as the dollar amount that a player could be making to be brought up under an emergency recall with no cap impact. So things like that, like it's so many little things that, you know, when they happen in, you know, I think as a fan, if you didn't know about the CBA, there'd be little things that sort of make you furrow your brow and go, How did that happen? That makes no sense. But the more you dig into it, the answer to most of the questions of that makes no sense is, well, actually, in section such and such of the CBA, they have a rule about that. So it's like going to a foreign country where, you know, I'd say it's a lot like going to Quebec as an Anglophone, where, you know, you could get by without French. I mean, all respect to the French speakers in your class and nationwide. I think generally speaking in Quebec, you can get around without much French, but I think you miss out on a lot of stuff that you'd be picking up otherwise. So I think it's, you know, I think you get a richer experience speaking both languages than you would by speaking only one and just muddling your way through.
A richer experience. Very well described there. Absolutely. So in your position, and you're a managing editor of a website, you have your credentialed media, you're at these games, you're at practices. What do you think that the knowledge or the familiarity or the facility with the CBA exists among NHL players?
I think the players probably are aware of the stuff that really impacts them. So, I mean, players probably know who can and cannot have a no move or no trade clause. I think they're pretty well aware of how close they are to free agency, how close they are to arbitration, things like that. But I think for the most part, you know, I think, you know, unless you're getting close to the cut line, I don't think they really know much about the waivers process or waiver exemptions or expiries, things like that. I think if it involves you, like, I think if we're all very self-centered individuals on a daily basis, you know, we usually experience the universe as it relates to us in general. And I think especially for legal documents, I mean, you don't give a hoot about waivers until you have to worry about either getting, you know, waived and sent down to the minor leagues or claimed and have to pick up stakes, move to Arizona on a whim. And, you know, I think if you have a family, those things matter to you a lot more than if you're just a single person moving around the continent, chasing a dream. So I think I would say most of them probably are pretty well aware of the stuff regarding specific contracts. I'd say restrictions on movement, like waivers and what kind of clauses they can get to avoid moving. But I think beyond that, I think they're all, you know, they're aware of it to the extent that they feel they need to. And I think the nice thing is for them, almost, you know, everyone has a player agent that is much more versed in the CBA and the minutiae than they are. So I think most of them probably know as much as they feel they need to get by. And then if they have questions, they just call their agents and ask them any questions they have.
Excellent. And you mentioned a topic here where it really only is something that is brought up when it affects players. That makes sense. As you mentioned, that's familiar to all of us, where it's like, I don't know the minutia of my employee handbook until there's something I need to actually look up. And then it's like, oh yeah, I should know this stuff. There are some issues though that seem to keep cropping up and are of, I would say, direct importance to all NHL players. And I think it's very little understood in the wider fandom. And that is that of escrow. And could you give your best attempt to describe the issue of escrow for our students here?
Oh my goodness. Players hate escrow. So let's see. When the 2005 CBA, the salary cap CBA, got put in, the split of revenues was 43% for the players and 57% for the owners. And, you know, at that point, you know, the players, they lost the season. They lost, you know, they got a salary cap put in. The big thing for the owners in 2005 was getting cost certainty. And, you know, the context of that was, you know, with the market I'm in, I cover the Flames. The Flames almost relocated a couple times. In the 90s, there was the Save the Flames campaign to basically drum up season ticket holders over the summer because they you know, they were having some cash flow issues. Most of it was due to the American dollar being so much higher than the Canadian dollar. And so when Gary Bettman came in initially as NHL president, his big contribution working with the small market NHL teams was something known as the currency equalization program, where basically there was a formula, a kind of soft revenue sharing, where the smaller market Canadian teams basically got a top up based on where the currency was valuated during the previous year. It was the first time the league really got involved in revenue sharing. And then, you know, as they started getting into the CBA negotiation in 2005, I think they liked how that worked. And so they adopted the model a bit, but the revenue sharing model really only worked if you knew how much money you were spending, which really led to the NHL, you know, really playing a hard line in the 2004, 2005 negotiations about having cost certainty. So that led to, you know, the NHL didn't like using the term salary cap because of at the time there's negative connotations to it. Now I think it's much more accepted practice. So at the time they used cost certainty was Gary Bettman's big buzzword. And so they ended up getting the cost certainty that cost everyone a year of revenues, which people just loved back then. But they ended up getting cost certainty and ended up being like a 57-43 split skewed towards the owners. In the 2013 negotiation and lockout, it became more of a 50-50 split. And I think for the players, that felt more equitable because, you know, the players getting 50% means that, you know, they're equal partners. And I think for the owners, I think it's a recognition of the contributions. Like, you know, as much as the owners putting up capital to build arenas and, you know, facilitate all the things that are going on, it's really not, you don't have a leak without the player. So I think the NHLPA was pretty happy with how that worked. Where escrow comes in is, so here's basically how the salary cap comes about every year. So usually starts about now. Usually, you know, right about now in the league offices and the NHLPA, the NHL accountants will sit down, look at the books for the previous year and say, here is more or less how much revenue we expect to make this year. And then based on numerous factors, they look at, you know, year over year growth, demographics, marketing, all kinds of different factors. They come up with projections for revenue for the following year. And then they send those to the NHLPA. The NHLPA has their accountants look at it. And, you know, right now, the NHL's revenues are about $5 billion. The hockey related revenues, basically any, you know, direct revenue based on NHL activities and NHL team activities. There's a lot of things that go into it. You don't need to read that part of the CBA. It's very dry and it's about exactly what you'd expect. Under the current CBA, the NHL is projected $5 billion in revenue and the NHLPA gets half. So that means that the player share is forecasted to be $2.5 billion. You divide it by 32 teams and that's your cap for the season. Here's the issue. What if your forecasts are wrong? And that's where escrow comes in. Escrow is basically a percentage of player salaries held back on every paycheck that will be given back if to the extent that the NHL's forecasts were correct. So if you're Johnny Gaudreau or, you know, Mark Giordano or whoever, and you sign a contract that pays you a certain number a year, that's not the real number you get. You actually get that less the escrow percentage. So it makes your paychecks a little bit tinier. And the problem with escrow is, you know, if you're a player, you know, you want to get the contract that you signed up for, not that less 20%. And the other challenge is NHL revenues are really complicated. And so, you know, I believe we're 2 years behind right now on escrow paybacks, escrow checks to players. And imagine if you're a player and, you know, you're playing, you know, you're very physically and mentally demanding sport. It's, you know, physically unforgiving. There's a lot of players who get career ending injuries and stuff. And so a lot of them just, you know, they understand that, you know, the money is one of the reasons why they're sort of protected from risk. And if you have 20% of your pay held back and then you get usually they get a chunk of it back. I don't think there's ever been a case where they don't get any escrow back at all, but you know, it's something that's it's kind of a bitter pill for the players to swallow. And so one of the big things they put the last CBA negotiations took place during a worldwide pandemic where no one was playing games. And I think there's a certain amount of risk mitigation being done on both the owners and the players' standpoints. But one of the things the players' side really wanted was a cap on escrow. A cap on the percentage of their paychecks will be held back. And so as a result of that, I mean, based on the 1920 season losing, I think the Calgary team lost about the last dozen games and then played in a bubble with no playoff revenue and then played in a bubble in Canada with no revenue whatsoever for another year. The players were estimated to owe about $1 billion heading into the season in escrow, basically money that they would need to pay back the owners to make the share for each given season 50-50. And they'll be paying that back with their escrow probably for another two seasons. So escrow, it's something that they really don't love. I think the players sort of get the point of it, But like the answer to the previous question, you can understand escrow conceptually and go, well, yeah, that makes sense. I'm okay. You know, I guess it makes sense if everyone's paycheck is held back a little bit to make sure that the shares are equitable. But when it's happening to you and you're like, my wife wants me to take the kids on vacation or put a down payment on a house or whatever, you know, adult stuff. And then all of a sudden you're looking at your paycheck and there's 15% missing. Yeah, you know, it's when you thought you signed up for a certain amount of money and then there's 15% missing, even if you get it back in 2 years, you're not gonna be terribly happy about not getting the full piece of the pie you wanted.
Well, that's a great description. Holy moly. And this is why this issue is extremely important to players. You talk to players all the time. Every single day you do your job, you're talking to players, you're talking to managers. I think it will take some time to pause on what you just said there. It's not 0.7%. It's, I think, 15, 17, 18%. That's an enormous amount of money. Like, that's 180 grand on $1 million. And that's a big deal, right? So I totally understand what you're saying. And part of the thing that, you know, we're talking about in this class about the structures of collective bargaining agreements is, you know, that stuff that you fight over at the table. Because from the player's perspective, you could totally say, look, your projections being incorrect is none of my business, none of my fault. And also, why would you be incentivized to provide accurate forecasts if you have a mechanism in place to make you whole no matter what? So you can see why in the collective bargaining framework in the NHL's calculus, I don't see what is in it from the player's side. And you can see why players get furious about escrow, because again, everyone learns salary details. Everyone does the, you know, the cap trading in their heads, but nobody realizes the fact that, not to mention tax, on top of that, there's essentially a bad accounting tax, or, you know, a bad thing happening insurance tax on you, the labor.
And the weirdest thing is, like, in theory, if the NHL underestimated the revenue growth, then there would be a swing the other way where every player would get, they have a formula. I don't think they've ever had to use it, but there is a formula where if the NHL underestimates their growth, then the players get basically a check. Everyone gets a little bit of a bonus, but I don't think the NHL's ever underestimated their revenues. They habitually overestimate the revenues to the point where if I'm the players, if I'm negotiating, I go, why is this the mechanism we've chosen to use for this?
What a strange coincidence, Ryan, that the NHL has never, oh man, their accounting must be just, they must fire their accountants every single year, because that is literally the exact inverse of the accounting practices in the private industry. In business, if you did that every single quarter, you would be out of business. Your shares would plummet.
I mean, let's in all due respect to the NHL accountants, we always know that they have ears everywhere. You know, the forecasting revenues for, you know, it's 32 different markets with 32 different peculiarities. You basically have to talk to 32 different teams and then any number of other revenue streams the NHL has to figure out. And then you got to sort of pull it into something that looks semi-coherent, and not just semi-coherent, something you can present to the NHLPA's accountants and say, here is the underlying principles of what I want to do. And so to the best of my knowledge, the NHLPA's accountants more or less come to the same conclusion that the NHL's accountants do. So, I mean, I think it's basically a case where they build their forecasting with certain assumptions in them. And a lot of times the assumptions are just a little bit, a little bit optimistic. I think that's the phrase the NHLPA would choose to use, because, you know, they would love if revenue grew 20% year over year, they'd be ecstatic. I mean, the nice thing for the NHL is, you know, in a few years when the escrow debt is paid off from the pandemic, there's, you know, I'm sure everyone in the class has heard, you know, at some point on cable news, the NHL signed two really big TV deals in the United States with ESPN and Turner Broadcasting. And they haven't seen any of that money hit the salary cap yet, because they're getting that money, but because of the escrow payments, they're still paying off the other one. So they're operating basically under the old salary cap formula. In a couple of years, teams are going to be like, the nice thing is they actually have, because of the pandemic was the reason, because of the pandemic, they changed somewhat the formula that they're using to calculate the salary cap. It based on the escrow payments, I don't think it'll be something that they really need to use until the very, very end of the CBA, if not the next one. But they're using more, the new formula is what they're calling the lag formula, where they basically look at cumulative revenues from the previous couple of years and then average them out and then go, okay, I think the formula from what I remember is they take the last couple of years, average it out, look at the growth over that period, and then apply that to the current year's formula. So they're trying to build a little more conservatism into it, but it's never going to be an exact process. And I think that's if I'm the players, that's the thing that sort of I'm grumpy about. But if I'm also the players, if I'm advising the players, my answer is probably also, I don't know if they can come up with a perfect way of doing it because I don't think one exists.
Well, I mean, again, far be it from me from challenging NHL accounts. In fact, quite the opposite. They do an amazing job. In fact, they do exactly what their job is, and that is to provide the best statistics that they have available. The longstanding concern, this goes back to antitrust negotiations with baseball in the United States, has always been open up your books and we can help you figure out what's fair. If you're this from whether you're Marvin Miller or whether you are Donald Fair, that's always going to be a contention because you mentioned right away that the CBA is a living document, and you're right. But you're dealing with like three or four different kinds of businesses here. And when one of them that's running up against this is unionized labor. And this is something that's very, very, very important to CBA negotiations. We just saw this happen in baseball. We're going to be seeing in every sport always is you have a unionized labor force, which means, you know, you should be always advocating for the health of your union. The question is, of course, in most unionized bargaining situations, you don't have very public negotiations for advertising deals where at one side, Gary Bettman can be claiming growth to Turner and to ESPN, say, hey, hockey's growing, we have healthy revenue streams, and at the same time, go back to your union negotiation and say, actually, revenue's flat. So you see how like what's very, very, very complex about this situation for hockey fans is to sort of understand what the actual health of the sport is, because on one side they see, oh, a huge TV dollar has been sold. And if you read the press release from ABC, they are happy to trumpet the growth of hockey. But then they go to the negotiating table and they say, hey, things suck. And that's why we're taking parts of your paycheck. So how do you think that the hockey is able to negotiate this tricky landscape with a unionized workforce and also dealing with the private industry built on top of it when the private industry deals are driving revenue?
The short answer is that's complicated. Because I mean, even something as simple as, you know, the example, they're selling helmet ads now, the first time in the league's history. They started doing it during the pandemic. For disclosure, folks, pretty much every arena, actually, I think it literally is every arena, because I was going to say except Madison Square Garden, but Madison Square Garden is literally owned and sponsored by the Madison Square Garden company. So nominally speaking, they advertise themselves. But every arena has a corporate sponsor, and you know, typically, you know, during broadcast, during any number of things, you know, you'd have, you know, the name of your business that sponsored the arena prominently featured on the ice and in all the advertising. Because the 1920 season ended early and they ended up completing the playoffs in a bubble, what ended up happening was, if you're Scotiabank, for example, in Calgary, instead of having your arena name mentioned a certain number of times on television, you don't. And so the make good that they came up with was helmet decals. It used to be that the advertising on the helmets didn't exist. It was just a sticker on the side of the helmet that said the team name. And now it's corporate sponsorships. But the challenge is, you know, the first year was just done, basically given to these arena sponsors primarily as a make good. For prior money they gave the teams for this advertising. This season, they sold it as just, it's a regular ad. It's a new ad, it's new revenue now. The challenge is not every market selling them. I think more than half of the league has not sold their whole docket. A handful of teams haven't sold either. And they're beginning to offer in the 22-23 season this coming fall, advertising much like they have in European leagues on the jerseys. It's sort of going to be a little bit patch on the chest of the jersey, depending on the design. And there's some concerns amongst a lot of people in hockey business that money they're going to make off it, because in some markets you have advertisers like the Toronto Maple Leafs are not going to have a problem selling the advertising on that. Neither are a lot of big market US teams. But you know, a lot of the Canadian teams might have issues with it. A lot of the smaller American teams might have issues with it. And I think that's one of the things that they're trying to navigate, because you know, on one hand, you know, you'd say, you know, viewership is up. They're making, you know, pretty good ad revenue. One of the things that's really driving revenue for a lot of sports leagues, UFC really recently saw a big wrestling jump in their TV deal. Actual viewership has been downward and getting older every year. The demographic that really matters to advertisers on television is the 18 to 49 age group. The average WWE viewer is 53 years old. They're actually, their average viewer is older than that key demo. But because those fans watch consistently live and they don't PVR it, you can't PVR live sports. That's the thing that's really driving revenues for live sports. The other challenge is now we've had a 2-year pandemic where a lot of fans in a lot of markets couldn't watch their sports live for various reasons. Some of them didn't feel comfortable. Some of them weren't allowed to by local health officials. And some of them just would rather stay home. And a lot of markets now in Canada, especially, you've had a fan base that's been at home for 2 years watching your TV coverage. And, you know, they kind of like it. They don't have to put pants on to go watch games anymore. And so they're fighting a lot of different trends in a lot of different markets. And I think if you're Gary Bettman, you're trying to, you know, when you talk to these, you know, high level groups, you try to provide a high level summary. And the high level summary, if you're Gary Bettman as the representative and emissary for the NHL's 32 teams, revenues have never been higher than in hockey history, which is great. I mean, you know, it's good for the health of the overall sport and its ability to grow and continue to, you know, provide jobs and, you know, livelihoods and in a lot of cases, entertainment for a lot of people. And on the other hand, if you look at sort of the individual constituent elements of revenue, there's a lot of noise there. And I think depending on who you're talking to, depending on the audience you're chatting with, that's the degree to which you factor in the noise, because, you know, I think they're looking for as many ways to drive revenue as possible. But, you know, some of the revenue areas, you know, even just like the helmet decals, some markets, boom, they're sold like that, sold like hotcakes. They barely had to try. Some markets, they've been trying really, really hard to sell those and they haven't had any traction.
Well put. Ryan, last question, because we've taken up so much of your time. If a student, like a student in this class, for instance, wished to learn more about the CBA, what would be the advice that you'd give them?
Best advice I can give you is read it. It's available for free on the NHLPA website. Just Google NHL CBA. The two documents it'll give you is the 2013 CBA, which is technically expired in 2020. And the MOU, the Memorandum of Understanding for the new CBA is there. There's no new CBA. The extra 70 pages are merely an addendum to the existing CBA and tell you what's changed, which is lovely because I wish they would just reprint the whole thing and just change a bit more. Other than that, if you recommend anything you can read with contracts, I mean, as absolutely nerdy as it sounds, if you read things like the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, the British North America Act, like anyone with a political science background, just, you know, those documents are they're reasonably accessible documents. And the way they're structured sort of teaches you sort of how the legalese folks built the CBA document and why they phrase things a certain way and why clauses are built the way they are. So, but yeah, the easiest way to get your feet wet is just dive in and read it, because there's a lot of things that as you read it, you know, the way I learned about it was reading and taking notes, and then anything you don't understand, Google it, because the nice thing is there's plenty of people in the public sphere right now who are doing just really cool analytical work and analysis work, examining different aspects of the CBA and how it's changed and evolved over time, and the things they like and the things they absolutely loathe about the document.
Ryan, thank you so much. You are one of those people doing that great work. You're a credentialed media member. You're also a capologist and a CBA expert. Follow Ryan on Twitter. Thank you so, so much for joining us, Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so that's another week full of awesome discussions with some really interesting people. And again, if you have any questions for Ryan, pass them along to me. I'm happy to put you in touch with him. If you have questions about how to join his career path, let me know as well. He's a wonderful person to get into contact with and really generous with his time. And we also had a visit from Byron earlier in the week. So remember, this is your audio response question, and you are going to be asked to specifically reference something from the guest lectures at a specific time during the guest lecture. I think we've had a little bit of slippage in terms of this regard, in terms of students not quite remembering to do that. I need you to do that so I can go and check and listen. I really do enjoy those of you who are doing this correctly. I think it's been a really fruitful process, frankly, and I think it's one I'm going to continue. I'm really impressed with some of the things that I'm hearing, and truly, I mean, I'm noticing such growth in so many of you, and to the point where I'm like, wow, I hope one of you or a few of you at least are interested in maybe delving a little more into the audio realm, maybe create your own podcast. I think that I know that it's intimidating at times when you think to yourself, ah, well, everyone has a podcast. That's true. But honestly, at the end of the day, it's about getting yourself out there and making mistakes and trying on your own as well. So if you're interested in it and you're finding it fun to sort of talk about these issues, then yeah, why don't you try it? Get a friend together, do it yourself, find someone who has maybe a different perspective than you do, and just start it. It'll make your analysis sharper. It makes you a better writer, I find it. But that's a different topic for a different day. If you have any questions about that as well, feel free to reach out to me in that regard. But today's audio response question is, if we were to collectively bargain the NHL draft out of existence, which means we are going to collectively bargain a replacement for the NHL draft, what would it be? How would it work? Use the information you've got from the articles, use the information from the guest speakers, and specifically tell us how your new solution would work. But again, consider the collective bargaining agreement, how it works. Consider what we learned today about how things work on the side of the players, on the side of the owners. Make sure that your new arrangement satisfies both sides adequately. Detail how it would work, but if you were to collectively bargain out the NHL draft, how would it work? What were the mechanisms in place, and why would it be collectively bargained on both sides? Looking forward to hearing these responses. I encourage you to be creative in this regard, and I hope you all have a wonderful weekend.